From WXXI News, I'm Jasmine Singer, and this is Environmental Connections. Today's Environmental Connection began when 33 protesters were arrested at Citibank's headquarters in Manhattan during Earth Week. The demonstrators were calling for Citibank to stop funding fossil fuels. This was just one of many protests happening globally, part of a much larger movement of climate activists engaging in civil disobedience, including Greenpeace-led Fire Drill Fridays in 2019, in which 82-year-old Jane Fonda, among many others, was arrested in climate change protests. But while we've seen these climate actions worldwide, they raise many questions. Does civil disobedience work? What kind of personal and legal risks do activists face? Are there other ways to protest that are just as effective, but maybe legal? Today, we will be diving into those questions, exploring the impact of climate arrests, and considering both sides of the debate on civil disobedience. I have an in-studio guest who is on her way, who is from Rochester Extinction Rebellion. And on the phone with us, we have two attorneys from the Climate Defense Project, which helps to fill a gap in the legal landscape by supporting water protectors and land defenders and other community-led campaigns with movement-aligned legal representation and advice and resources and referrals. First is Alex Markhard, Executive Director of the Climate Defense Project, who has extensive experience in climate law and defense strategies. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Also from Climate Defense Project is Kira Kelly, who has spent years working alongside movements fighting everything from fossil fuel extraction to corporate repression. Welcome, Kira.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having us.
So grateful that you're here. Alex, as someone who has worked to defend activists like Linda, who is hopefully on her way, how do you see the legal landscape evolving when it comes to the types of climate protests that I was mentioning at the top of the show, and with the rise in arrests and legal consequences? Is it facing a tougher crackdown?
I think so. I think there's been kind of an evolution in response to this new era of mass civil disobedience that you're referring to. I think things really got started with the Keystone XL pipeline, which began in 2009. And then we had a lot of other big projects, too, that came into the public consciousness, including the Line 3 replacement pipeline in Minnesota, the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota and other states. Atlanta was in other states as well. And then Cop City, or otherwise known as the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, which is kind of the latest thing. But I think there's been kind of a change in the narrative. You saw sort of an anti-terrorism narrative start to be used during the Bush and Obama administrations among law enforcement. And there's been an uptick in critical infrastructure and other anti-protest bills since 2017. Which has increased the criminal penalties for protests.
Alex, I'm going to need to interrupt you for just a second. We're having a little bit of a hard time understanding you. So I'm going to go to Kira and have you work with our producer on the sound.
Okay.
Kira, let's turn to you. You've supported activists through both legal defense and on-the-ground work. I've read that CDP has argued that sometimes turning down a plea deal to go to trial can actually hurt the movement more than help it. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you help activists navigate those tough decisions?
Sure. The thing that I always tell clients is to start by asking yourself the question of what is the goal and then evaluate strategies. Sometimes I think, particularly when dealing with activists, as opposed to people who are maybe criminalized not on purpose, that not everybody has the privilege of choosing to risk arrest, right? We know a lot of laws in our country have historically criminalized people for things like poverty or being a person of color, being queer or trans, that activists are sort of in a unique position where sometimes they're choosing to risk arrest. And really, that's the only distinction that I see coming up between representing an activist or representing somebody who didn't choose to risk arrest and all that means to me is that we've got a responsibility when working with people who made that choice to really think about what they're doing in court and to think of it as you're choosing to be here. It's important to ask why. And I know that a lot of people sometimes value trial for the sake of going to trial because of maybe other incidental benefits that happen when a activist goes to trial that they could instead pursue more directly. So if people want to go to trial because they want their community to come up and support them, then can we more directly ask for opportunities for community building and support? I think that the distinction, the difference really is that sometimes you don't have a good plea deal on the table, and that we've seen, for example, in New Hampshire, there have been arrestees that are protesting a weapons manufacturer who are seeing severe charges that are not proportional to the conduct at issue and seeing harsh plea offers that are not comparable to offers that are made for similar offenses that are unrelated to anti-war protesters, anti-genocide protesters. So in those situations when the plea offer really isn't a good option and would require people to face significant jail time, fines, criminal repercussions, that's a different situation. That's a really hard decision because you've got to balance the certainty of a plea offer that's not a great outcome with the dice roll of going to trial. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of empathy for anybody, whether they chose to risk arrest or not, who has to make that decision. Do you choose a known harsh option, or do you choose the dice roll of potentially a good option or potentially even a much worse option? But there are some situations when activists have plea offers on the table that they could take and then get out of that case with pretty much no legal repercussions, no jail time, no to minimal fines. And in those situations, that's often the hardest decision for activists because they feel like they're giving up when they take a deal. So encouraging people to really try to like engage in movement work on their own terms and to not kind of get caught up in the, I have to win that trial. I have to stick it out. I have to suffer because that makes me more effective, and really trying to push back on that, saying, hey, we're inherently valuable as humans. Like, you can choose the terms of your own engagement with the movement. And if you've got a really good plea offer on the table, why not take it and then save that energy you would have otherwise spent on trial on doing more organizing and relationship and community building and movement work?
Well, and we'll talk all about that as well, because I know a lot of our listeners are very curious about the climate arrests that have been happening, but also they want to know how to get involved in different ways that might not have legal ramifications. Alex, I know you're back, hopefully with clearer sound. Can you give us some examples of recent local climate protests that have involved civil disobedience and what the outcomes were?
Yeah, you know, that's actually more a question for Kira. You know, there have been a lot of kind of national protests that people may have heard about that I think really kicked off this era of mass civil disobedience that we've been involved in, some of which we've been involved in. You know, starting with the Keystone XL pipeline, of course, in 2009, the Line 3 replacement project in certain Western states, including Minnesota, where Kira works sometimes, the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016 and 2017. And I think the latest thing has been Cop City, otherwise known as the Atlanta Public Safety Training Center, which got going last year. And I think, you know, we've seen a response to all of this in the form of new anti-protest bills, including some critical infrastructure bills, which kind of specifically deal with oil and gas sites. And so this is certainly a changing landscape, mm-hmm. And something that is more in the public consciousness than I think it used to be.
Kira, can you weigh in on that as well? Just some examples of recent local climate protests or climate protests that you've been involved with that have involved civil disobedience, and tell us about the outcomes.
Sure. I am actually just gearing up for the first court appearance for a group of defendants who were arrested in Newington, New Hampshire for climbing a smokestack. There's been a campaign in New England to shut down peaker plants. These are predominantly coal and some gas facilities that are really only running during a small fraction of time per year, And they wouldn't be needed at all if people adopted small behavioral changes like charging their phones at night when it's going to be really hot out the next day. These are not facilities that provide really any necessary capacity to the grid, but actually cost a lot of money to be kept online. And so there's been a lot of pushback in New England. The campaign is called the No Coal, No Gas campaign, and I've been really honored to support them quite frequently over the past couple of years in their campaign. There are some civil disobedience direct action components to the campaign where people are protesting. A group of people in 2019 locked down on a train track to prevent a train that was carrying coal from coming and delivering that coal to the power plant facility. And we went to trial on those cases. And there are other lawful components of that campaign, such as doing community organizing, flooding the power grid meetings, and really getting involved in the nitty-gritty. How is it allocated resources to like keep these essentially dinosaur plants online when they have no functional use to society? And so there's all types of, we call it diversity of tactics here, but the most recent event in this campaign was a group of people climbed a smokestack and dropped a, I think, 175-foot banner down the side of it that said, "No coal, no gas," the campaign slogan. So they were arrested upon their return to the ground.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, is that something that you're seeing more and more often, Kira? As the urgency increases, are you seeing more and more people wanting to actually partake in civil disobedience?
I think there is more and more a willingness to take risks, recognizing that, like, people are starting to recognize that not getting involved is more risky than choosing to take legal risks. And something you said earlier made me think about the importance of distinguishing risking arrest from breaking the law, because a lot of times people are arrested for things that are may or may not be unlawful. And what is deemed in violation of a law is sort of a moving target based on behavior that the state or identities that the state wants to control or suppress. So we see more laws popping up and different interpretations of laws that are increasingly imposing severe criminal consequences on activists, particularly who are fighting for decolonization, racial justice issues, and particularly activists who are really challenging the status quo of the corporate state and of the ability of these massive fossil fuel and weapons industry corporations to make a profit at the expense of our lives, our future, our safety, our well-being. So I think people are really getting fed up with it, and they are willing to take more risks or to get more involved, to get outside of their comfort zones. But to say that they're breaking the law is more like people are willing to do what must be done, and the state is increasingly trying to criminalize that.
That's Kira Kelly, staff attorney at Climate Defense Project. And we're also joined today by Alex Marquard, who's the executive director of the Climate Defense Project. We are talking today about civil disobedience, and there's just been more and more arrests lately. We're waiting for our local activist who has had some trouble getting here today. But let me ask either of you a question. Beyond arrests for civil disobedience, what is the landscape for whistleblowers and their protections? Do you have any advice for people who see gross environmental degradation and want to come forward, but maybe are worried about blowback? Alex, do you want to jump in with that one?
Yeah. So we don't do a lot of work with whistleblowers. It's a really important subject, as you kind of mentioned. I think there are a variety of things that can happen to whistleblowers. Some of that involves retaliation by employers. There's also an increased trend that we're seeing involving lawsuits by entities that are the target of protests. So a lot of this in our work involves pipeline companies, involves other kinds of wealthy entities as well.
I need to interrupt you again, Alex. I'm so sorry, but we're still having some audio problems. So I'm going to turn to Kira. Do you find that activists feel pressured by their own communities or by public expectations to go to trial, even when a plea might be a better strategic move for them personally?
I think people feel pressured perhaps by any number of sources, and sometimes it's pressured by their own good intentions and commitment to making the world a better place that they feel like they need to make the biggest impact possible but they aren't quite sure how to do that. Mm-hmm. So I do think people sometimes feel pressured to go to trial. And, you know, definitely as an attorney, like I have my own opinions. I think it's a lie for anybody to say that they're neutral on a topic. But my strategy as an attorney is to be upfront about where my biases are or what my opinions are, and then to be like, okay, but I'm going to support you with whatever decision you make. I just want to make sure that we're considering all of the factors when we make that decision. So when folks are considering whether to go to trial, I also want to try to give them a realistic expectation of how much work it is, even for a defendant, even when they've got a pro bono attorney. I send a lot of emails and text messages to clients. There's a lot of decision-making points. It's a lot of time and energy finding housing and even just finding ways to cook when you're staying in a crummy motel near the courthouse and feeding yourself over a multi-day court event. It's nerve-wracking to be on trial, even for a misdemeanor. So making sure people understand the energy that's going into it and making sure people have a why. A why are they going to trial? Mm. Are they going to trial because the plea deal that's being offered is really about the same as what they might get if they're found guilty and sentenced? So they're going to try for the acquittal because there's not a ton of legal risk to continuing to go with a potential significant legal gain. Are they going to trial because they want to get information in the discovery process or by questioning witnesses, law enforcement, or representatives of these coal plants or what have you, and that information might be valuable to bring out in a trial process to then use to better inform the campaign and their strategies? There's all kinds of reasons. The one that I really try to push back on is people feeling like they have to go to trial because they feel like some sort of inarticulable moral compulsion. Mm-hmm. The other one that I try to push back on is sometimes people are like, I don't want to plead because I don't want to say I'm guilty of a crime. I'm not a criminal. And I like to push back on that because I think that as a society, we really stigmatize people with criminal records when a lot of times people are criminalized for things that are not harmful. They're just a feature of being targeted by prejudice and biased laws. That it's an arbitrary stigma around criminals when there really isn't a correlation between crime and harm that we should be giving value to. So really just trying to push back on that and saying, if you want to go to trial, as long as there's a strategic reason that furthers your goal, let's go. But definitely pushing back on the pressures from other people that really aren't as intimately familiar with each defendant's unique situation and reasons.
Thank you for that. I think that brings a lot to the minds of anybody who would want to get involved, because the environment here is what's at stake. And I know we have a caller. If anyone else wants to call in to weigh on this discussion, please do. 844-295-8255. But Kira, before we get to our caller, can you just tell us what's at stake? Let's just get in real simple terms here. Why are people making these decisions? Why are activists choosing to partake in civil disobedience?
Sure. I mean, I think everything's at stake, right? The whole world is at stake. And I was talking to a friend the other day about just what's happening right now is the apocalypse. And depending on our level of privilege, we may or may not be feeling it personally. But you can see what's happening in Lebanon right now. That's an apocalypse. You can see what's happening in Gaza, in Palestine. That's an apocalypse. And those are environmental issues, too. I always try to push back on people that try to separate environmental from indigenous and racial justice, because you can't survive if we're not all thriving. And if you need an environmental reason to kind of care about this, the military-industrial complex is the biggest polluter. Mm. So if we can join in solidarity with Palestine fighting for their homeland and for their right to exist, their right to not pick up the remains of their children in backpacks. That is the best thing we can be doing for the environment, is joining in solidarity with people that are being victims of colonization and of these other drivers of climate change, and recognizing that we're not free till we're all free. Mm. We're not safe till we're all safe, and we're not going to have a livable future unless we work for a livable reality right now. So a lot's at stake. People are immediately right now in this moment feeling the apocalypse. And then people are doing family planning, choosing not to have kids because they don't want to bring new living humans into a world where we might not have clean drinking water in 30 years. Like we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, I think the doomsday statistics are pretty widely known and well documented. And I really feel for the climate scientists who have been kind of trumpeting this for years and having to live in the realities of where we are and where we're headed as a species and as an ecosystem, and having to hold the heaviness of that reality. I think people start to explore that, and then they get to a sense of desperation because they're like, how are so many other people ignoring this?
Mm. Let's get to our caller, Margaret in Rochester. Margaret, thank you for calling Environmental Connections. What is your question? Thanks.
Well, so I'm in a bit of a pickle. I am in a group that is feeling the effects of climate change faster than the average person, and that all of the wildfires and the smoke from the wildfires devastate my lungs because I already have lung disease, and I want to be a part of sounding the alarm and letting people know like how serious this issue is. My problem is that I was arrested when I was a teenager protesting anti-gay legislators on Capitol Hill, and I was put in a holding cell and my inhaler was confiscated. And so the jailer knew that I had asthma and went around and just blew smoke into my cell the whole time I was in the cell. And I realized at that point, like, I can't with my chronic illness be arrested. But my chronic illness is why I feel so compelled to take action. So do our guests have any suggestions
wow.
for me?
Yeah.
Thanks so much. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. That is quite a story. Alex, I know you're back again. Thank you for bearing with the sound issues. Can you address Margaret's concern? She wants to get involved with environmental change, and she's concerned that her disability might really come back and haunt her. That's a terrible story that she told.
Yeah. Thanks for bearing with me as well. I think there's so many ways to get involved, right? And you don't have to be sort of the one on the front lines getting arrested. I think for every person who gets arrested, there are three or four people behind them who are playing support roles behind the scenes, you know, who are doing that even more kind of unacknowledged and really important work. And so, you know, we always tell people to sort of get involved with campaigns in your area and to just do like what moves you as an individual, right, where you feel most comfortable engaging. It doesn't have to be in a high risk sort of arrestable position, but I want to see what Kira thinks about this as well.
Yeah, Kira, what do you have for Margaret?
Yeah, I agree with everything Alex said, and Margaret, I definitely just want to like appreciate you for your commitment and for recognizing that it doesn't have to be the person going to jail, like that we should really be valuing contributions to the movement that are strategic and rooted in compassion and relationship, just as much as we're valuing kind of a more like macho masculine, like getting arrested and going to jail. And sometimes people equate suffering with efficacy, but in fact, there's just so much to be done that we shouldn't feel like we have to fill any one particular role. And I also have learned a lot. I think it was the Disability Visibility Project had a resource. It might have been Ajaris Dixon. Yeah, that's who it was. This incredible organizer in, I think, New York City, who came up with this this article called 26 Ways to Be in the Struggle Beyond the Streets. This is just one of many examples of the ways to be supportive of the movement that don't involve the sort of traditional locking down to something, getting arrested, going through an onerous court process. And something that I have learned from some really brilliant legal worker friends of mine is that there is such a vital importance to the emotional labor that is often unseen in movement works, whether that is jail support. You're the person that's helping somebody navigate the experience of getting arrested or going to jail or going through a court process, or you're helping do care work for the group as they experience these hard things. That being in the movement is really hard, and fighting an uphill battle and contemplating the violent realities of the world we live in. I think we do have this kind of like care scarcity, this like lack of emotional labor available for people that really need it. And so we're really struggling collectively, and a lot of that emotional labor that's already being done is unseen. I find myself talking to clients and we'll spend an hour and they'll just be venting. And I'm like, I want to give you legal advice, but actually you really just need someone to talk to right now. And I know that the invisibilizing of emotional labor is and care work is particularly true for folks of color, and particularly women and femmes, queer folks, disabled folks. They're already doing so much of that labor. And Margaret, just from hearing your call, it sounds like you're already a caring, compassionate person who's showing up for your community. So I think for me, I would just encourage you to like recognize that work as a crucial part of the movement, and encourage everybody to be acknowledging and valuing and like leaning into that work, leaning into the care work as just as much of an important part of making the world a better place as going out and risking arrest.
Yeah, that's a great message. Thank you so much. Now, one more question before we go to a break. And for those of you who are listening, this is Environmental Connections. I'm Jasmine Singer. And we're talking today with a couple of incredible attorneys from the Climate Defense Project who are really working hands-on with people who are choosing civil disobedience as their way of creating change when it comes to climate and environmental issues. If you want to be part of this discussion, if you have questions or stories that you want to share about your own experiences on the front lines, the number to call is 844-295-8255. That's 844-295-TALK or 585-263-9994 if you are local. You can also email us at connections@wxxi.org. Alex, Kira, I know it probably depends on the type of protest, but what are the charges that are generally brought against such activists, and how much time might they be facing?
Yeah, Kira, do you want to take this one?
Sure, I could take this one. It really depends on several different factors. I would say the predominant factor in at least how police treat you when you're being arrested is the demographic identities of the people that are getting arrested. In New Hampshire, I saw a group of 65 predominantly white coal plant protesters walk onto a coal plant and get arrested by law enforcement who were helping them make sure they had water, checking in constantly to attend to their health and comfort needs and giving them places to sit, et cetera. I saw 5 years later a group of predominantly Muslim and/or people of color, slightly younger crew, many of whom were queer, get arrested by 70 riot police who were, they used pain compliance, their tactics were brutal, they really took these people and tried to cause them pain. And the charges were the same. Both groups got misdemeanor trespass charges, but the difference is in the demographic identity of the protesters. So that's one factor, is how law enforcement treats you. I think the other factor in terms of what charges are brought, that has more to do with are people causing property damage. And, again, Alex and I are not giving anyone legal advice or telling anybody what to do or not to do, just observing trends in what we've noticed through our work. I do tend to see higher charges when people are dropping paint or breaking windows or taking any kind of action against physical infrastructure when they're just trespassing, when they're just kind of sitting down someplace or not moving beyond that, the charges tend to be lower. And then the other factor too is just, what's the cause? What are people protesting? We do see more severe charges and a reluctance to negotiate plea deals when folks are protesting issues that are more intersectional. For these strictly environmental protests, sometimes we see less hesitation to negotiate more favorable plea deals. We see lower charges, we see lower sentences, et cetera. So and then regionally too, there's just, there's even a difference between New Hampshire and Maine. I had a meeting with a co-counsel this morning who was saying that he can't get a trial in Maine, that the charges get dropped before trial for a lot of protest cases. Whereas in New Hampshire, unless there's really no evidence, I rarely see a trial get dropped unless it's a situation where I had a trial dropped last year because we challenged the use of the loitering and prowling statute as unconstitutional. It's essentially you can get arrested for loitering and prowling if you exist somewhere under suspicious circumstances. And that statute typically gets used against unhoused people as a way to give a legal pretext to then further search, arrest, detain someone. It was used against a climate protester. We tried to take it to trial to challenge the statute as unconstitutional, and that charge was dropped rather than be subjected to that challenge so that law enforcement could continue using that statute as a tool to continue surveilling and harassing unhoused people. We got lucky with that trial dismissal. I think generally in New Hampshire, we don't see dismissals pre-trial unless there's really no evidence.
Ah, okay. All right, well, thank you. I have some follow-up questions for you, but we're going to go to a very short break first. When we come back, we will be talking with Kira Kelly and Alex Marquard from the Climate Defense Project. If you want to be a part of this discussion about climate arrests and just what to do if you care about the environment and don't know where to put your energy, please give us a call, 844-295-8255. We'll be right back.
I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, The Wall Street Journal recently profiled the first gay married couple in this country. And we wondered, who is the first same-sex married couple in Rochester? Well, we're going to talk to one of the first. Bess and Ann talked to us about how their life has been in the year since their marriage, what some of the conservative predictions meant, and what life is really like. That's Monday.
I'm Jasmine Singer, and you are listening to Environmental Connections, which is on the air the last Friday of every month. You can also check out the Environmental Connections TV show by going to pbs.org and typing in Environmental Connections. Today, we are discussing some very important topics that I think we're seeing more and more in the headlines, which is arrests by people who are involved in climate-related topics. And we're being joined today by Kira Kelly, the staff attorney at Climate Defense Project, and Alex Marquard, executive director of the Climate Defense Project. We have a caller who has a question, and I'm going to let you in right now. Krishna from New York, thanks so much for calling Environmental Connections. What is your question?
Oh, hi. Mike, I wanted to get more involved with environmental activism, but I would not want to be arrested. So what would be some good ways for me to get more involved?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for calling. Kira, do you want to take that?
Sure. I think I would always encourage people to start local and to start from a goal of relationship building. Kind of look around you and see who's already engaged, and also to kind of to ask yourself, we call it vocation. What is your skill set or your gift that you might bring to a movement space? Are you a good cook? Are you a good listener? Are you good at holding a lot of information and coming up with strategies? Are you good at reading nitty-gritty rules and regulations that govern regulating processes or understanding the power grid? And that gift is something that could be really useful to any number of groups that are already working in your area. So kind of look at, is there anything that's happening locally that you could go to a meeting and introduce yourself? And I know sometimes it can be like, especially with COVID and pandemic precautions and in-person lack of accessibility issues, but I would say a quick Google search for what's going on in your area is a good way to start. And I don't know if I have any specific recommendations based on your location, so it's hard to say, but if you can't find anything, starting something, and then if you've got people that you can bring with you, like, that's often a great place to start. Or even just I would say there's like a lot of national groups that have local chapter affiliates as well, and if there isn't a local chapter affiliate in your area of a national group that really speaks to you, often adjacent or neighboring local affiliates of these groups and organizations can help you get going or start one up in your area. But if you're in New York City, there should probably be lots of people already out there doing work that you would find meaningful. I think that one recommendation for me when you're looking at how do I find a group to get plugged in with is to try to make sure that group is aligned with your theory of change. So personally, I don't really hold much faith in electoral politics. So that's not part of my theory of change. Again, like community organizing, grassroots movement building relationships, that's more how I think change happens. So I'm more likely to look up a mutual aid group in my area than like look up a group that's helping a politician campaign for office, because I want to find a group where my theory of change is the same, so that we're just going to work better together. So I don't know if I should maybe define that term, theory
of
change.
Yeah, actually, I was just going to ask you, tell us what you mean by theory of change.
Yeah, you're going to have a much, much better time, and it'll feel much more fulfilling to work with a group who aligns with your theory of change, which is just like, how do you think the world gets from the oppressive, violent, doomy and gloomy world of suffering that we live in right now to a liberated, joyful, egalitarian world where people have the resources to meet their needs? And how we get there is your theory of change.
What is your theory of change?
My theory of change is, I think this is in my bio, I believe in the abolition of police and prisons as the horizon that we work towards by removing funding for punitive, coercive, highly energy-intensive methods of suppressing and controlling, and shifting those resources upstream towards things like education, housing, healthcare, the arts, so that people have the resources to meet their needs, and so that the problems that we think we need police and prisons to solve actually don't exist. And then we find that that all of these resources that get poured into prison after prison, militarized border after militarized border, fighter jet after fighter jet, bomb after bomb, that all of those resources being plugged into community gardens, subsidized public housing for low-income folks, art spaces, theaters, music venues, that we won't actually have the problems we think we need prisons and police to solve, including environmental devastation, that really you can't separate it.
I appreciate the way that you're framing the arts as a key part of this whole worldview here. I think it has historically been very important to various other movements for social change. And to that end, so has civil disobedience. Can either of you speak about some examples of civil disobedience from history that you have seen maybe succeed a little bit so that we have something to grasp onto to emulate?
Yeah, so like this is something that comes up a lot. I think we hear people making a lot of comparisons, right, between the climate protests of today and some past civil disobedience movements in this country, including the civil rights movement and the movement for women's suffrage earlier in the century. And I think these comparisons are really important, right? The tactics are largely the same as they were then. You have to put pressure on people in power, and you do have to create some amount of disruption for people to kind of sit up and take notice. At the same time, I think it's important to recognize the differences today. We have a very different kind of media and political landscape. And there's a lot more civil disobedience than there used to be, I think, in part because our political system isn't working very well, as you may have noticed. There's been kind of a mainstreaming, I think, of civil disobedience, like as a tactic, among people in social justice movements. And with that has come a lot more repression, as we've been talking about. It's also just harder to get attention these days because we're so overwhelmed by digital content. So I think you have to be, you know, a little more careful and more strategic these days doing civil disobedience to kind of make the impact that people want to have when they think about these earlier movements. But there remain really important parallels. And there's so much great writing and great theory that came out of these earlier movements and the lessons that were learned. Civil disobedience is not a new tactic at all, but I think it hasn't been until recently that people have really widely understood the power of it and accepted that nonviolence can be even more effective than violence in many ways.
Alex, have you seen any patterns in how different regions or states are treating climate activists legally? Are some areas more tolerant than others?
I think some areas are more tolerant than others. I mean, I would say that what Kira was talking about when it comes to your identity as an activist is probably still more important than anything else. But, you know, I mean, certainly on the international level, we only work here in the U.S., but there are many countries in the world where it's quite dangerous to be an environmental activist, including, you know, some parts of Latin America, for example. it can be dangerous here too. You know, you're more likely to see really draconian charges in, you know, politically conservative states when you're engaging in climate activism and getting arrested. We've seen charges like domestic terrorism and federal charges, felonies rather than misdemeanors. But it really, really depends on just kind of the specific facts of what you're doing, who you're involved with. And we certainly don't want to suggest that it's a bad idea to protest if you're in a conservative state. I mentioned anti-protest bills. You know, those are more predominant in some of the conservative states, but not necessarily only there. We've seen these bills passed everywhere. And some states that you would think would have a pretty good track record that are more politically progressive, but that have pipelines, like Minnesota, for instance, can still sometimes have kind of a poor track record in cracking down on protests.
What are some of the specific challenges that activists might face once they're in the legal system? And are there cases where going to trial is the right choice? How do you determine that? Either of you who wants to weigh in?
I can weigh in. I think just like the challenges include the fear of the unknown. That's really the big one, is people get charged with something where the maximum sentence is a decade, and just having the possibility of spending a year in prison, even if the likely outcome is that you'll plead out to a misdemeanor and serve a couple of months to no jail time, just having that charge, and that the tactic used by prosecution is to overcharge to incentivize pleading to a lesser offense to avoid that scary unknown hanging over your head. I think that's one of the biggest factors. The other thing too with environmental protests is a lot of environmental protesters are taking on this risk out of a fear of the climate apocalypse, that they're, as they become aware of it, and they might not have had prior contact with the criminal system before. So this is a lot of people's first arrest, and maybe it's even like the first time that they've been to a courtroom before, or the first exposure they've had to the possibility of jail time. That a lot of climate protesters are not coming from communities that are otherwise intensely criminalized. Just naming the environmental movement as a predominantly white group, not to erase the work of Black, Indigenous, and people of color environmentalists, but just to say a lot of us are white, and so we don't have as much of that familiarity with the system. So the fear of the unknown is sometimes greater. Even questions, I get questions like, if I get arrested, can I wear glasses in jail? And just being like, oh, like, this is stuff that folks don't know when they're really being thrust into a system that they've never had contact with before, it can be really scary. And I think just naming the emotional aspect of being criminalized as something that's really important to work together to support folks through, and to encourage people to do solidarity work with incarcerated people and their families as you are or before you are thinking about your own incarceration, is a good way to like really understand that, hey, this system's not fair. And to not come into court with an expectation that it will be fair, because for so many people who haven't chosen their contact with the system, they've learned time and time again that actually nothing about the system is really designed to support compassion, logic, or common sense. It's really designed to maintain the status quo and concepts like property ownership.
Let's get into, go to one of our callers. John from Rochester, thank you for calling Environmental Connections. What's your question?
Well, many experts out there think that man-made climate change is exaggerated. I would ask your panel on whether they have any regrets in their protests. When they protest, they intimidate people and they trespass, etc. Do they have any regrets if they're wrong on man-made climate change?
Thank you for that question. Alex or Kira, do either of you want to address John?
I have a semantic distinction I would love to introduce. This isn't like the universal truth, but it's a framework that I've found really helpful. I'm hearing us use the words civil disobedience, protest, and direct action somewhat interchangeably, and I like to actually think of them as three different things. Sometimes they can all be present in the same activity, but generally they each mean something different. I use civil disobedience to refer to somebody intentionally breaking a law to show that law is wrong. So an example of this might be if, the sit-ins in the civil rights era, there was segregation laws and people intentionally broke them to show how wrong those laws were. Direct action, I think of as people using their power as individuals in a community to directly accomplish their goal. And protest I see as people talking to somebody who has power over them and saying, hey, please use your power over me in a better way. So if I go to the governor's house and I hold a sign and I say, give me health care, I'm protesting. Or if I hold a sign that says, stop polluting, and I go stand in front of a big factory, I'm protesting. I'm saying, you have power over me, please use it better. Direct action is where I say, hey, what's the world I want to live in and how can I build it directly? And that doesn't have to be unlawful. Sometimes there's totally lawful ways of doing this. I think a great example is in small town Vermont, where I grew up, we have town meetings and we as a town can vote on how we want to spend town resources. So the town actually voted to fund a community nurse. So local town money gets allocated to this person who just goes around town and like helps take care of people. And maybe we couldn't influence the governor to give us all health insurance or the state legislature, but we could hire somebody to provide health care for the community. And it's been really effective and really powerful, but totally lawful. And so that's an example of lawful direct action. To get to the caller's question, I realize I took us on a bit of a sidebar here, but I think that it's always important to acknowledge the impacts of our actions and to minimize harm especially to people that are, that are not consenting to that interaction or that we're not aware of. And I think in a situation where we're protesting about climate change, it's important to distinguish discomfort from harm. It's also true when we're talking about racial justice. Some people are uncomfortable with the concept that Black Lives Matter, but that discomfort is actually due to their own racism, which ultimately is at the root of the harm. Ignoring the realities of climate change is the root of that discomfort and is in and of itself a really harmful mindset. People might be upset at being asked to confront the realities of their participation in a system that's killing everyone, but I think we owe it to each other to like compassionately but firmly embrace conflict and embrace journeying together towards truth, and that really we've got an obligation to try to like see how we're impacting each other. And it's a morally appropriate thing to do to point it out when somebody else is causing a lot of harm.
Alex, do you agree with Kira? Do you have any regrets going back to the caller's question? Anything that you wish you had done differently?
I think, yeah, the thing about, making people uncomfortable with protests is not a bad point to raise. I mean, I referenced kind of the way that various forms of protest, of which civil disobedience is one. Thanks, Kira, for making these distinctions. The way that that's been mainstreamed in recent decades has meant that it's been used a lot more. And I think there's this sort of growing backlash. But if you look at a lot of the theory behind social movements, it really is important, and I think when you're doing it well, it's important to build public support with your protest or your direct action or whatever it may be. That's kind of the touchstone of social organizing, growing public support, not necessarily with every single choice that you make, because as I said, you do need a certain amount of disruption. You do need to make people uncomfortable. But over time, right, you need to kind of change hearts and minds, or else you're not really advancing the movement. I think civil disobedience and these sort of public disruptions really go hand in hand with changes to laws, progress in the courts, all these things that we think of as like more traditional avenues of political change. And so I see things like protest and, political work as being really complementary, even if they're often kind of framed as being antagonistic. And so I think we actually need all of these things, and we do need people to be uncomfortable sometimes. And I think that's what our work is designed to support.
Mm. Alex, thank you for that. I appreciate kind of normalizing that for a lot of people, this is outside of their realm of what they think about or how they want to get involved, if they want to get involved at all. Are there statutes in place that are specifically designed to enhance punishment for activists? The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act comes to mind. Can either of you address that?
We see nationwide.
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay. We do this all the time on staff meetings. We see nationwide an increase in bills being proposed that are targeting protests at what we call, or what the bills themselves refer to as, quote unquote, critical infrastructure. So if I trespass in my neighbor's yard, I might get a misdemeanor. But if I trespass on a construction site where a massive fracked gas pipeline is being built, that might be elevated to a gross misdemeanor or even a felony in certain jurisdictions. It's the same conduct, but when it's done on certain locations, the penalty is significantly enhanced. And those certain locations are the sites of construction and development of these industrial infrastructure projects, which I think we can directly attribute to the influence of these massive energy corporations on state and federal legislative officials and essentially lawmakers listening to Enbridge, who says we don't want to deal with another Line 3 in these next jurisdictions, or Energy Transfer Partners, or all these other kind of affiliates and subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. And we have to close. But Alex, just very, very briefly, given the legal risks and the public backlash and the slow pace of policy change, very briefly, what keeps you motivated to keep pushing? 20 seconds.
I think working with people younger than us, to just use an example that people often do, has been most exciting for me. We work with a lot of college campaigns, including some of the folks arrested for Palestine solidarity protests, and that's been really inspiring.
That is inspiring. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank my guests, Alex Marquardt from the Climate Defense Project and Kira Kelly. I'm Jasmine Singer. Until next time, thank you for making today's Environmental Connections.